Silas Arthur Schuster. It sounds a peculiar, yet familiar name, right? The same unplaceable strangeness struck the Viennese onlookers and well-wishers gathered at St. Stephen Cathedral in 1778. They had assembled for the baptism of baby Benjamin, whose parents, Johann and Maria Schuster, had decided to name him in honor of the three American representatives in Paris: Benjamin Franklin, Silas Deane, and Arthur Lee. So great was their admiration for the revolutionary trio that the baptism entry recorded the American representatives as godfathers in absentia. Buoyed by ineffable feelings of fatherhood, Johann Schuster wrote to his newborn's first namesake within a week. He informed Franklin of his pride in their little American, who served as a daily reminder of the illustrious and dear people who strove for liberty half a world away. What you've just heard is the beginning of a book called The American Revolution and the Habsburg Monarchy, written by British historian Jonathan Singerton, now professor at the University of Amsterdam. Today, we are traveling to Habsburg Monarchy at the end of 18th century, and on this journey, we will be guided by Professor Singerton. He's going to tell us, what were people living in the monarchy thinking of the America before and during the American Revolution? And how was the monarchy and its citizens involved in the war on a distant continent? My name is Tihana Kuster, and you're listening to a history podcast. Dear Professor Singerton, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, I would like to ask you maybe the hardest or the simplest question. Why Habsburg monarchy and why American Revolution? Why did you choose to research their connections and the influence of the American Revolution? It seems as though past historical works wasn't thinking about the connection of the two.
It's a very good question to start with, indeed perhaps even the most important question. Really, for me, it's a very personal question. As I was a young student, an undergraduate student, I studied German and history. And as part of my studies, I was able to travel to Vienna for 1 year to study at the University of Vienna. And before I was a student of German history, I was always interested in the American Revolution and in American history. As a child, I was very lucky that my parents took me on holiday to America to see not only beaches and places like this, but also historic sites and places. And so I was incredibly interested in American history, as well as the American Revolution in particular. And so when I arrived in Vienna, as a student in around 2011, I was particularly interested then in Habsburg history and in the history of Central Europe. And so it was only natural for me to put those two things together to see what had happened in Vienna and in the Habsburg monarchy during the time of the American Revolution. And there were a number of works that have been written before my book that deal with the American Revolution and the Habsburg monarchy in certain ways. But I didn't find that these works answered the entirety of what I wanted to know, or didn't answer everything that I wanted to know. And so I set about then beginning this, first of all, as a bachelor's thesis, and then as a master's thesis as I studied American history, and then naturally as my PhD at Edinburgh a few years after that. And really, it took me on this journey then of self-discovery to find out about the American Revolution and then its enormous impact in Central Europe.
Before we start with the revolution, could you please tell us, what did people living in the monarchy think about America before the revolution?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. It's a very important thing to think about, so that we don't assume that people in the Habsburg lands simply encountered the American Revolution with a blank mind. Instead, they had a rather preconceived idea of what America meant. And I begin in the book with that preconception, that understanding, that pre-understanding of America in the so-called Habsburg mind. And what I mean by that is what people of all backgrounds, nobility and ordinary people, thought about the Americas up until the American Revolution. So if America was rediscovered as such by Christopher Columbus in 1492, there were many ideas of America coming to Europeans, and particularly to Central Europeans from that time onwards. And in the 15th and 16th centuries, these ideas were mainly generated by religious perspectives. So by missionaries, particularly Jesuit missionaries, who had traveled over to the Americas to prophetize, to convert people there, but also then wrote back home about their experiences. They wrote to their friends, they wrote to their bishops, they wrote to their communities. They even wrote then published texts about their experiences, which helped then to color the general impression of the Americas. Combined with that, you also had ordinary people, townsfolk and general people who went to church every week. And when they would go to their local churches, their village churches, there were often depictions of America as an allegory, as a made-up version of what America meant, sort of like a logo today. And so they could look at the ceilings, at the paintings and the frescoes on these ceilings, and often they would see allegories of the four corners of the earth, Asia and Europe and America and Africa. And the American image was often distilled into this stereotype of what America was back then, often a half-naked sort of American Indian with a feather headdress or feather crown, often accompanied by an exotic animal such as a crocodile. And these tropes and these stereotypes then were very typical of what people perceived the Americas to be in the time before the Revolution, as a place of wild indigenous quote-unquote savages and people like that. This changed, and I argue this in the first chapter of this book, this changed rather rapidly on the eve of the Revolution in the mid-18th century, when people became more aware of a British North America, of the colonial system in North America, where there was a lot of enterprise, where there was a lot of merchants, and more importantly, where there were troubles occurring between the colonists and the British in general. So then you had people in the Habsburg monarchy write books and tracts and pamphlets about these disturbances, but more and more aware of the manufacturing place of North America, as well as then the more European side of North America, its culture and its society. And that had changed then rapidly up until the eve of the American Revolution.
And what happened when the war broke out? How did, first and foremost, the Habsburg family, court, and the nobility react?
It's a very good question indeed. So first of all, when war broke out, the Habsburgs were swept up into this war almost immediately. The war, by the way, I should say, starts, let's say, in 1775 with the first skirmishes of the Battle of Lexington Concord. Later, of course, it erupts into much wider war, and you have the American Declaration of Independence then 1 year later in 1776. But immediately around this time, there were conflicts and there were skirmishes involving the Habsburg monarchy. So in the Austrian Netherlands, nowadays Belgium, the port of Ostend saw some of this early action when American pirates in particular would sail to this port of Ostend trying to obtain weaponry and gunpowder and things like this to fight the war. This caused problems for local officials who wished to remain neutral. This caused problems for administrators in Brussels as well as in Vienna who also wanted to remain neutral. And so they were very early on swept up into the effects of this war. The same then for the dynasty at large. They were aiming to stay neutral in the war. They wished to stay neutral partly out of fear of the British and of British reprisals against them, but also because they wished to spite their ally France. And it's important to remember that the French had sought to use the American Revolution against Britain to weaken Britain and to get revenge on Britain for losing the Seven Years' War and where they lost Canada to the British. And so the French then quickly supported the Americans and were allied to them in 1778. And at this time, the Habsburgs were allied to the French. So very quickly, they had the fear that they could be brought into this war as allies of the American allies as well. Now, the British, the Habsburg monarchy and the dynasty and the rulers themselves have a very particular interest in the American Revolution, first and foremost because they are the rulers who are going to be affected by it politically. The Empress Maria Theresa, for example, had a very keen interest in the American Revolution. She read political tracts and letters that were translated by her physician, Dr. Jan Egenhaus, a Dutch physician who had come to Vienna to inoculate the imperial family. And he was a great friend of the American revolutionary Benjamin Franklin. And he translated many of Franklin's letters sent for Maria Theresa, as well as wrote essays defending Franklin and the Americans, which she read and to inform herself. So she was particularly interested in the revolution from the beginning, but also in a way to defend against it, to guard against its effects geopolitically. She also represented the dynasty's interest with her two sons. So her son, Joseph II, was Holy Roman Emperor and her co-ruler at that time, and then became the sole ruler of the Habsburg monarchy after her death in 1780. And Joseph II is particularly interesting because he had a large degree of sympathy for the Americans. It's quite clear to see this in his correspondence with the Empress Catherine the Great of Russia, where he often describes the Americans in rather sympathetic terms. But another clear distillation of his interest in the American Revolution comes from his trip to Paris in 1777 to meet with his sister Marie Antoinette, the French queen, as well as his brother-in-law, King Louis. And Joseph has a list of people, thinkers and luminaries and famous individuals who he would like to meet on the way to Paris. And among those was, of course, Benjamin Franklin, the most famous American revolutionary at that time. Indeed, he cannot meet Franklin as a private audience or indeed as an official audience because it is too politically difficult. Franklin, of course, is a rebel leader to many, especially the British in Europe at that time. And so it is too politically dangerous for Joseph to openly meet with Franklin. So instead, it is arranged that they will meet as private citizens for a hot chocolate under the auspices of the Tuscan ambassador and delegation. And so the two men agreed to meet for hot chocolate. Franklin turns up for the date with the emperor, waits for a while, waits for a little longer, and waits a little longer after that, and then eventually decides to leave. And just after he's left, the emperor shows up. Now, we might assume that the emperor was less interested in this date with Franklin, but that wasn't at all the case. It turns out, and it's something I was glad to find out about in my research, that the British knew about this meeting, thanks to their spies amongst Franklin's circles, and they decided to stall the emperor, to prevent him, to stop him from meeting Franklin over hot chocolate because of the legitimacy and the recognition that such a meeting would carry. So they decided to disrupt it. They couldn't disrupt, however, the interest of the son of Maria Theresa, Grand Duke of Tuscany, Leopold, who later becomes the Holy Roman Emperor after the death of his brother in 1790. And Leopold, at that time, was working upon a constitutional project in Tuscany. He was very keen to enshrine the rights of Tuscans. After his eventual succession, it was known that he would probably succeed his brother from an early period onwards. And so he wished to protect the rights of his citizens in Tuscany in a new constitution. Now, among a number of other European constitutions, he chose as his model the American Constitution, Constitution of Pennsylvania of 1776. And it's quite intriguing to see his essays outlining his thoughts and reception about this constitution, where he writes something along the lines of, to begin a perfect constitution, one must begin with the principles espoused by the Americans, namely equality and liberty. And so the son of Maria Theresa, future emperor himself, has these ideas about liberty and democracy directly from the Americans. And it's quite an astonishing thing to read and to behold.
What about ordinary people, common people, citizens, intellectuals? How did they react? Mm-hmm. We already heard about the case of baptism of Benjamin Silas Arthur Schuster.
Indeed, and it's very important not to forget the ordinary people in that sense. I would only say about, in thinking about the ordinary people in Habsburg monarchy, it's rather difficult to think of what the ordinary person was. It was such a diverse, interesting region of Europe. It was, of course, an empire of a population of around 20 million people, with many diverse backgrounds and nationalities and languages and so on. But we can get a sense of what the average person thought about in the American Revolution, thanks to a few interesting examples, quotations and insights. We, of course, lack documents from these people, letters and so on, essays. They didn't write the same things, of course, as the emperors and the rulers and the nobility. But we can get an insight into their general reception through other quotations and documents left behind. And one of those is written by a newspaper editor, a Hungarian newspaper editor, who writes in 1783, after the end of the American Revolution or the War for American Independence, and reflects on the meaning of the American Revolution for the people in Hungary and in Central Europe in general. And really his point in this column in a newspaper that he makes is that people's perception of the world and people's recognition of the world has changed fundamentally thanks to the American Revolution. He writes, for example, that up until the War of American Independence, conversations in villages was often about the favorite dog or the best dog, the gray dog or the black dog or the brown dog. And now actually people's minds have been turned towards greater things. They've been turned towards the political events in North America. And in many ways, it reflects then the media impact of the American Revolution. It's a bit like today when we read or talk about the war in Ukraine or the death of Queen Elizabeth II. This is an event that unifies us all and is something that ignites us all. We discuss it, we talk about it, but we are aware of these places. We are aware of what's happening in those places. And that was the point made by this Hungarian newspaper editor, that people in the Habsburg lands, the ordinary average people in villages and so on, were reconceptualizing their world thanks to the American Revolution. Indeed, as he put it, up until the American Revolution, who knew whether the Atlantic was east or west? But now, after the American Revolution, they certainly knew where the Atlantic was, where America was located, and so on. We also get an insight through other evidence of the average person's response to the American Revolution, thanks to the letters that survive in the papers of Benjamin Franklin. As I pointed out, Franklin was the major celebrity of the American Revolution. He, of course, is one of the people whom baby Silas was named after, but he is also someone that is deeply representative for many Europeans at that time of the American Revolution. He's famous before then as a scientist and as a discoverer, mainly, of course, of electricity and the conduction of electricity. But he becomes famous during the American Revolution as a political figure. And many people in the Habsburg lands send letters to him. He receives over 250 letters from over 100 different people in the Habsburg monarchy. And they really come from all parts of the monarchy, from places like Linz and St. Pölten to places on the border with the Ottoman Empire in southern Hungary, to places in Slovakia and Bohemia and Prague and so on like this, really from all corners. And they write various reasons to him, mainly sometimes offering crazy ideas, like they have a new recipe for gunpowder that they want to sell him, or sometimes simply to offer their sympathies to him and to support the American cause and to voice their support for the American cause. But the fact that you have many different types of people writing to him, military officers, school teachers, and so on, demonstrates the wider impact and interest in the American Revolution among, let's say, the more ordinary people.
Were the subjects of the monarchy in any way directly involved in the distant war on the other continent?
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question, because you had indeed Habsburg subjects who fought for and against the Americans in the War of American Independence. The people who fought against America were often those who were part of the Hessian regiments. And to explain the Hessian regiments, those were groups of military forces belonging to German princes princes who were then sold to the British to support the war in America. Because after all, the British had a rather strong navy, but a rather weak army. And so they relied upon these German troops, these soldiers, to fight their war then in North America. Many Habsburg subjects had joined the ranks of these regiments on their own volition, for their own reasons. Either they were soldiers or they made good money, but some of them were recruited by specialist agents who picked upon people to join such military organizations. These agents often used rather underhand tactics, telling them how great their life would be in America, that they'd only have to fight one battle and then they could own some land, or simply that they would make good money doing so. Some agents, rather bad agents, even kidnapped people and forced them into military service as well. So you had a number of people then, numbering at least in the hundreds, who belonged to the Habsburg monarchy but fought as part of this Hessian force in North America. And indeed, we have a diary of one Austrian soldier who was part of that. He had joined at Amsterdam and joined the Hessian forces there and fought in almost every major battle in America in the American War of Independence. And his diary provides insights not only into those battles and those experiences, rather difficult experiences, but also into his views about American society, as he was in New York at the beginning of the battles, and he finished in Charleston, South Carolina, where he was exposed, of course, to plantation slavery, and he wrote about his experiences and his perceptions of the plantations. So that's also another unique insight, but it was one that was likely shared by many Habsburg subjects fighting against America in the war. For the people who fought for America, we have a rather prominent example in the figure of Joseph Kaufmann. Now, Joseph Kaufmann sounds like a German name, but in fact, he was a German-descended man who was born in Philadelphia before the beginning of the American War of Independence. So he was born a British subject. But he was from a Catholic German-speaking family, and so he traveled first of all to Belgium, to the Austrian Netherlands, where he studied, and then later he moved to Vienna, where he studied medicine at the University of Vienna. Indeed, he was the first American-born student of the University of Vienna, and in his entry log of the university, you see that he is written as Philadelphius, so as a person born in Philadelphia. Joseph Kaufmann, as a student at the University of Vienna, had a bright future ahead of him. It was one of the best universities at that time for medicine. And throughout his studies, as a very good student, he was thinking about where he would go after his studies, where he would become a doctor and where he would make his money in Scotland, in London, in Paris, or even in Vienna. What he didn't consider was a future back in the American colonies. But as the war had broken out during his studies, and as he became more and more aware of the American Revolution and its ideas, he became more and more determined to help it. And so he wrote to Franklin, as well as his father, what about he thought of his duty as an American to help defend the American cause against British tyranny. And so it's for that reason that he brought together a bunch of other medical students in Vienna and left with them in the course of the war to go and fight on behalf of America. Now, sadly, we don't know what happened to all of those band of brothers, those students, but in the case of Joseph Kaufmann, we know that he was killed on a ship, an American warship, due to a battle with a British Navy ship. And in fact, the ship exploded and killed most of the men on board, including Joseph Kaufmann. So the first American-born student at the University of Vienna died fighting for the cause he passionately believed in.
Yes, it was really a tragic story. Let's move to the first diplomatic American mission to Habsburg monarchy, which is perceived in the history as unsuccessful. Why is that so? And what happened in the 1778 when William Lee came to Vienna? And what were the consequences of this mission?
It's a very good question. It's a very exciting and fascinating episode. In fact, the first diplomatic engagement between the Habsburg monarchy and the American Revolution. That was the first attempt of many to broker a political dialogue between the two countries. And as you rightfully said, it ended in diplomatic failure. You also mentioned the person who became the first envoy to the court of Vienna from the Americans. This was the man with the name William Lee. William Lee was descended from the famous Lee dynasty of Virginia. It's the same family where Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general during the American Civil War, is descended from. And William Lee obtained his position as the first envoy to Vienna, thanks in part to that family prestige. His brother was in the American Congress and helped to get him nominated. And he really needed this nomination because Lee, on the eve of the American Revolution, had been a merchant in London, a rather successful merchant. He had been also a sheriff there, as well as an alderman of the city, and so he was rather prominent. But as a prominent American at the start of the American Revolution, he had to leave London due to the anti-American sentiment that was growing there at that time. And so really he was without any possible future on the beginning of the American Revolution. And so, thanks to his brother, he was named in late 1777 as the envoy to Vienna. And his mission carried a lot of importance, since the Americans believed in three main principles when it came to the Habsburg monarchy. Firstly, that they should open up a diplomatic relationship with them, that it would help to legitimize and strengthen the American position if more countries would recognize them. Secondly, if they could continue to trade with the Habsburg lands, notably in Ostend, where they were trying to gain gunpowder and munitions and so on. And thirdly, if they could use the position of the Habsburg monarch, Holy Roman Emperor Joseph II, to stop the flow of Hessian mercenaries to North America. They believed that the emperor could do that. So this mission carried an enormous amount of weight and importance when William Lee left then in the spring of 1778 to go to Vienna. He was unfortunately aided by the Baron de Breteuil, the French ambassador. And I say unfortunately because although Breteuil, who later became the last prime minister of France after the revolution, was the very shrewd and able diplomat in Vienna and very shrewd representative of the French, he was also someone who was rather unpopular at court and particularly hated by Joseph II. Breteuil was also unfortunate in the sense that he tried to present Lee as a gentleman traveller, so someone who had no real diplomatic credentials. But the Austrians and the Viennese had blocked this because they did not want to upset the British. So before Lee had really been presented at court, there was already a resistance against Lee's mission and a refusal to accept him as an ambassador. So in turn, Breteuil had made things worse by trying to present him and force him upon the court as a gentleman traveller. And so even within sort of 2 weeks of Lee's mission, all those doors had become firmly closed. Now this created sort of another possibility and another success in some ways. Rather than seeing the mission as a failure, I see it also in terms of how it succeeded. It failed, of course, diplomatically to achieve those three aims of brokering a treaty, of securing economic ties, and of stopping the Hessian forces. But it had many successes in that it brought the American cause closer to the Viennese and helped to support the American cause more generally. William Lee, after all, had become something of a celebrity in Vienna due to the fact that his popularity at court arose from the mischief and the chaos that he had created by being presented at the court. There was one particular example where he was presented by the French ambassador at the same time as the British were introducing some British guests. And this, of course, caused a rather upset scene and a rather difficult scene diplomatically. And so people were rather fascinated by this person who could cause such problems at the court. And so he was invited to dinner party after dinner party and soiree after soiree, and people were very interested to interrogate him about American life, to know more about America through him. It was rather unfortunate then that he spoke not a word of German and that his French was so poor that he often made confusing remarks or mistakes when he was trying to express himself, and so again he had to rely upon the French ambassador. But the point is that his mission, although it failed diplomatically, helped to create a wider curiosity and excitement about the American Revolution and about its cause in Vienna among the nobility.
In one place in your book, you mentioned that your book serves as a maritime history of the monarchy. I imagine your constatation has a lot to do with the trade. During the war, how did the monarchy take advantage of the neutrality status, and for how long were they successful at it?
Indeed. So typical histories of the American Revolution and Europe will see that in a sort of political view. So they will see it purely as a diplomatic or political exchange, and they will write histories based upon, you know, pencil pushers and government officials and diplomatic dispatches and so on. When I wrote this book, I really wanted to have a wider view of the American Revolution and its impact and its exchange with Europe and with, in particular, Central Europe. And so giving space to the economics and to the trade and to the merchants within that story was of vital importance, because after all, politicians then and now listen more to money than most things. And so merchants had a great deal of agency in persuading and shaping the Habsburg response to the American Revolution due to the money that they could make. Now, to turn to the particular importance of the economic trade for the Habsburgs due to the American Revolution, we need to look at two places. The first of which is the port of Ostend in the Austrian Netherlands. And Ostend at that time was a rather small port, a rather regional port, but it grew thanks to the American Revolution and thanks to a particular relevance in the American Revolution as a place where foreign traders could come and protect themselves against foreign attack due to their use of the Habsburg flag. So they would use the Habsburg flag, which ensured protection as it was a neutral flag, over their own national flags. So French traders, British traders, Dutch traders would come to Ostend and swap their registration of their ships to own the Habsburg flag and protect their trade and protect their ships. There's also an additional reason that this port was near to the Prince Bishopric of Liège. And I wonder if you are questioning right now what the Prince Bishopric of Liège is. Well, today Liège is just a small city in Belgium, but back then it was an independent country that was in between two parts of the Austrian Netherlands. And Liège was very famous in the late 18th century for producing gunpowder, cannons, muskets, rifles, and all sorts of weapons needed to fight wars. In the early part of the war, the weapons were traded out of Liège via the rivers that flow down to France and out through the French ports, or northwards to the rivers up to the Netherlands and the Dutch ports. As the French joined the war in 1778, and then later as the Dutch joined a separate war, the Fourth Anglo-Dutch War against the British in 1780, those places were no longer neutral nor safe for trade. And so Liège traders sent their goods across the new canal network that had happily been finished in 1776 over to Ostend. And from Ostend, this trade exploded. So on the eve of the American Revolution, between 1776 and 1780, around 480 ships on average per year went in and out of the port of Ostend. But after 1780 and after the Dutch route had been closed, over 3,000 ships entered and left per year in Ostend. It was that big of a deal. And of course, this meant then that through taxation, the Austrian Netherlands grew quite rich, and then in turn, the Habsburg monarchy grew quite rich from this trade. The same was true for Trieste, although not to such a large extent. Trieste, located here in the Adriatic, and I'm sure more familiar to Croatian listeners, was a place of not particular importance in the early 18th century until the Habsburg rulers decided that this would be the site for the main exportation of Habsburg goods from the Central European lands. And so from 1718, when Trieste was made a free port, Trieste had really become then a major regional and even Mediterranean port. The merchants then who had been trained there and had lived there and worked there for decades were very experienced then in expanding their trade and finding new opportunities. And indeed, 1 month after the Declaration of Independence was pronounced, traders in Trieste were already lobbying the government in 1776 for opening up trade and supporting trade missions to North America, as they saw this as a very valuable market. It took a number of years until 1782, when the first ship, happily called the name L'Americano, they were very imaginative back then, sailed across the Atlantic as the first direct ship to sail between Trieste and North America. And it was a rather big and successful voyage. It traded manufactured goods, pots and pans from Styria, Bohemian textiles and glass from Central Europe, over to North America in turn for typical American goods, tobacco, rum, indigo, and sugar. The voyage was again very successful and led to another voyage later that year. And then in 1783, 1 year after that, a new company was founded by four very experienced Trieste merchants called the Austro-American Trading Company. That's how important these two connections were. And this Austro-American Trading Company indeed traded for a number of years between a number of American cities and the Habsburg lands.
And what happened after the war?
So after the war, the problems really started to occur. So in Ostend, for example, traders found that many of the foreigners who had come there to use the Habsburg flag simply went home. They had no need of the neutral Habsburg flag since they had no need for protection. There were no warships attacking them anymore, so they could simply return home to their own ports. And so trade in Ostend effectively collapsed. And the same reason, because there were no need for guns and weapons from Liège as well. In Trieste, it was a bit of a slower story, mainly because they had a rather good attempt at making this transatlantic trade with companies like the Austro-American Trading Company. But all of these companies couldn't compete against foreign firms due to the lack of a trading agreement between the Habsburgs and the Americans. So to explain, countries would found trading agreements between each other so that they could reduce tariffs and they could reduce costs in terms of trade. So traders in the Habsburg lands couldn't sell Styrian iron, for example, in Bohemia at $50 when you could buy good quality Swedish iron at $25, thanks to the reduction in tariffs due to a trading agreement between Sweden and America. So without this trading agreement, then effectively the trade slowly collapsed in places like Trieste and Ostend. And by the end of the 1780s, these great pushes and great ventures to establish these trading companies had all but ended.
So it seems as the turn of the tables happened for Habsburg monarchy. Why didn't the Habsburg monarchy succeed in signing the trade deal?
Well, to put it in just one word, Jefferson. So we are aware of Thomas Jefferson, who was the third president of the United States and is famous for being the author of the Declaration of Independence, although he wasn't so recognized as the author in the early part of his lifetime. But during this period, immediately after the American Revolution, he was an ambassador in France. He had taken over the ambassadorship in France from Benjamin Franklin. And as part of his time in Europe, he was to make new trade treaties with other countries. Now, Jefferson didn't do this alone. He also did this with his colleague and counterpart, John Adams, the second US president, who at that time was the ambassador to the court of St. James in London. Now, John Adams is interested in the Habsburg case because he had a rather positive view of the Habsburg monarchy. He had spent time in Europe during the American Revolution. He had travelled through parts of the Austrian Netherlands and had been aware of the explosion of trade and the importance of the industries there to the American cause on his way to the Dutch Republic and backward from there. And Adams also had many conversations with the imperial ambassador in Paris, Count Mercier d'Argenteau. And from his conversations with the imperial ambassador, he understood the vitality of the Habsburg economy and its importance and its interest generally in all of these manufactured goods that Americans acquired. He also had rather promising views about the future of the Habsburg monarchy. He knew from diplomatic sources and rumors and discussions and so on that the Habsburgs were go in to fight a war against the Turks with the Russians, and that if they had managed to overthrow the Ottoman Empire, that they would have a great access to the Black Sea, to the Eastern Mediterranean, and that they would be of supreme importance in terms of commerce and future trade. So he had a very positive view of the Habsburg monarchy. This was not the same for Thomas Jefferson, who had arrived again in 1784 as a rather new person to Europe and had rather a less clear understanding of the Habsburg monarchy and of European geopolitics at that time. He got a lot of his information from newspapers, and that was rather unfortunate since the Emperor Joseph II had entered into a war with the Dutch Republic. It was a short war over the question of opening the Scheldt River to commerce, and it had led to a sort of great disturbance then within the European balance of power. The same then in the years later with antagonisms against Russia, and then eventually with the war against the Ottomans. So from Jefferson's perspective, his new greenhorn perspective, the emperor was somewhat of a meddler. He was somewhat of a pain and a rather crazy sort of monarch, and someone who he didn't see as a possible future partner, or someone who was stable enough to be a future partner. And it was for this reason that Jefferson avoided any contact with the imperial ambassador. He avoided making a commercial treaty with the Austrians, although he made treaties with many other nations, because he didn't see them as suitable partners or of any great importance, which again was a stark contrast to John Adams. And it was because of this then that there was no treaty of friendship or amity or commerce signed between the Habsburgs, and their political dialogue, their political exchange was set back by around 60 years, because it was not until 1838 when the first official exchange of representation occurred. And really the 60-year delay from the first mission of William Lee in 1778 until 1838 is largely to blame Thomas Jefferson.
What about the ironic story of Jefferson's house and Bohemian glass?
Indeed. So Jefferson was a victim of his own bias in this sense. So Jefferson, again, had sought this negotiation and effectively stopped any negotiation for a treaty of commerce. And this came back to bite him. It came back to haunt him when he returned to America and then later resigned as Secretary of State. This was before he became President of the United States. And he spent many years in that period in the late 1790s, remodeling, building his house at Monticello, a fantastic place, nowadays a fantastic foundation and museum, which preserves his original house and legacy. For this new designed house, Jefferson wanted some of the best materials, and he chose, of course, Bohemian glass for the windows. This was a particularly notable glass for its good quality and its clarity, but also because of its strength. And it's for that reason, of course, he needed Bohemian glass for the cupola as part of the dome on top of Monticello, because of the strength of the glass. It was the only glass that wouldn't crack under the giant size of this glass dome on top of his house. But of course, as I pointed out, Jefferson was to blame for the end of the negotiations for a treaty of commerce, which meant that Bohemian glass was rather more expensive than if it had been traded under terms of a treaty. This was because the Bohemian glass had to go northwards, up through many tolls and canals and so on, roads, up to Hamburg, and traded out of Hamburg through other merchants. So there was a lot of additional costs for this Bohemian glass to go northwards than if it had gone southwards, down to Trieste, where there were rather fewer tolls and customs, and would have been traded under a Habsburg company. So Jefferson, in ordering around 1,800 panes of glass, paid a rather higher price for those compared to if there had been a treaty between the two lands, which he had prevented. And the same, of course, affected his neighbour, James Madison, when he built his house and had Bohemian glass imported. And the same went for the architect who designed the White House and the US Capitol building, both of which used Bohemian glass in the original versions before the British set fire to them in the War of 1812.
In the end, through your research, did you encounter any creations that were Habsburg subjects connected with the US?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So there's one particularly interesting, prominent example among many. This person goes by the name of Leopold Stupich. And Stupich was part of a team of botanists, of scientists, who traveled to the United States in the immediate post-war era of the American Revolution. I should explain how this story came about, because it is rather a fun reason, and also rather tragic reason, actually, because of one particular gardener who was rather negligent and lazy one evening and left open a window in the greenhouse of the emperor's gardens at the Palace of Schönbrunn. And this particular greenhouse housed many of the exotic plants that belonged to the emperor and that were collected from an earlier expedition in the Caribbean in the 1760s. And having such plants was not only important for scientists and researchers to study, but also for prestige. So many other rulers and many other nations had such displays of exotic plants in their own gardens, such as the Tuileries in Paris, such as the Kew Gardens in London, and the Dutch gardens at Leiden, for example. So it was very important that the Habsburgs then regain their collection of exotic plants. And so five men, including Leopold Stupich from Croatia, were chosen to go to America to collect new plant specimens and to also gather information on the natural life of the North American and Caribbean areas. Stupich was under the command of the overall leader of the expedition, a man called Franz Josef Merter, who was a professor of botany in Vienna at that time. They sailed across in 1783, in the summer of 1783, on the frigate George Washington, and they arrived in late September 1783 in Philadelphia. And from there, they traveled downwards to the Carolinas and then onwards to the Caribbean. And on this journey, they would often break off into smaller groups, either alone or in twos or sometimes threes, to collect more material before they would meet again in one particular city and package this material, send it back to Vienna, and so on. They had many problems throughout this journey, raising from trouble with money and currencies and exchanging notes, especially as many of the states had different paper currencies. They also had problems, of course, with gathering these plants and these creatures and animals that they were collecting, notably in the swamps of the Carolinas, where they came across alligators. And in one case, they had to spend all of their food money to buy a gun in order to defend themselves against these alligators. Stupich was rather fortunate in some ways, because he was also a good artist and could sell some of his works. And along with another member of the team, he settled in America. So he chose not to continue his mission and chose rather to settle in the United States. And indeed, he died there in Charleston a few years after the mission. The mission then was seen as somewhat of a failure because of these defections by two of its members. And the remaining mission members, such as the leader, Franz Josef Merter, were rather haunted by this. Merter became not so successful as his previous mission leader in Vienna. He was seen as a very good authority on such things, but he was not held in such high regard. Whereas the other two members, the ones who had stayed and returned then to the Habsburg monarchy, they were sent further to South America and then later to Southern Africa as well. So they were also rather highly regarded. But Stupich died and stayed, stayed and then died out in the United States.
Thank you so much, Professor Singleton, for sharing with us this exciting story. And I must say, I wish you good luck in all your future research.
Thank you very much for having me.